10 hours Greenwich Mean Time. In the World Service of the BBC, this is News Desk with Lucy Marshall. The headlines. For the 12th night running, NATO has carried out air raids on Yugoslavia. Local reports say various military targets were hit, including the Yugoslav Air Force headquarters. Missiles also struck Belgrade Airport. NATO says it's cutting off supplies to Yugoslav forces in Kosovo. As the United States strengthens its military presence in the region, the flow of refugees from Kosovo continues unabated. Reports say a queue many kilometers long is waiting to get into Macedonia. One other headline, the two Libyans accused of the Lockerbie bombing are reported to have been handed over to the United Nations, ready to stand trial in the Netherlands. Also in the next half hour, a new survey in Japan shows that business confidence may have begun to recover. NATO aircraft have carried out a 12th night of bombing raids on targets in Serbia and Kosovo. A NATO spokesman said an improvement in the weather had allowed the raids to be stepped up. He said NATO was succeeding in cutting off the ability of the Yugoslav government to resupply its forces in Kosovo. David Shukman reports from NATO headquarters in Brussels.
NATO officials say that last night was one of the most successful they've had since the air campaign began. Targets included military command centres and barracks, and also fuel stores and a railway considered vital for the military campaign in Kosovo. After many nights of bad weather, the skies over Yugoslavia were said to be clear last night, and the forecast remains good. The feeling here at NATO headquarters is that the tide in this campaign may now be turning. Sources talk of bringing the full weight of NATO's strength to bear. Additional forces are on their way as well. The US Navy's Theodore Roosevelt carrier battle group is due on station in the Adriatic imminently, and the Pentagon has approved the dispatch of 24 Apache helicopter gunships. These are seen as an especially potent addition to the NATO armory. One problem, though, is their delivery to Albania, where they'll be based. Officials warn that the airport at the capital Tirana can only accept a limited number of flights, and this morning three transport planes delivering aid to the refugees were among the aircraft arriving there. NATO faces a difficult choice about its priorities, either the effort to help the refugees or the air campaign that may ease the suffering of those still inside Kosovo.
David Shukman in Brussels. And as we heard there, NATO believes it's succeeding in cutting off the ability of the Yugoslav government to resupply its forces in Kosovo. Our correspondent Michael Williams is in the Yugoslav capital, Belgrade, and sent this report from on the latest air raids.
On the outskirts of the capital, NATO hit Air Force headquarters and the Yugoslav Anti-Aircraft Command. State television is reporting attacks on the barracks and training school of the special police, the force which enacts the will of Belgrade in Kosovo province. The authorities say NATO warplanes also fired missiles into the city of Niš, where the Yugoslav Third Army has its headquarters, and Serbian television is showing pictures of an inferno in the city and of the firefighters struggling to control it. Belgrade International Airport is also reported to have been hit by missiles, though there's no news yet on the extent of the damage. For NATO, these are legitimate strategic targets meant to increase pressure on the military, the police, and the political leadership. The authorities here call them the criminal acts of neo-fascist barbarians. Belgrade is asking for an emergency session of the United Nations Security Council. Whether as a prelude to compromise or merely as a forum to castigate NATO isn't clear. The latter is more likely given the growing defiance here. There were strikes overnight in Novi Sad in the north and in the south around Pristina, Sanjak province in the west, Niš in the east. At all points of the compass, the people of Yugoslavia are slowly waking to a new reality. Their national infrastructure, factories and fuel depots, airports, bridges and power plants are now on the list of targets for NATO's furious attention.
Michael Williams reporting from Belgrade. Nearly a quarter of a million Kosovo-Albanian refugees have now fled into Albania. As the international aid effort gears up to assist Albania, aid workers on the ground in the northern border town of Kukës are continuing to deal with at least 20,000 refugees a day fleeing from Kosovo. Many are crossing at extremely remote border areas, making the task of helping them even more difficult. From Kukës, our correspondent Clarence Mitchell reports.
According to the spokeswoman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees here in Kukës, another 25,000 people fled into Albania throughout the last 24 hours. The majority came through the main border crossing some 40 minutes' drive from here, but more than 4,000 of them arrived at Qafa Pushit, an extremely remote crossing much higher in the mountains, some 2.5 hours away. That presents the aid agencies with the immensely difficult task of getting transport, food and medical aid to them. Some aid workers at the border told me they believe the Serb forces are deliberately making people flee through ever more remote crossings to hinder the aid effort. Many of the latest refugees were from Jakovica, one of Kosovo's principal cities, and they told stories of the Serb forces clearing the main hospital of Kosovo Albanians at gunpoint, forcing those far too ill to move to flee as well. In all, at least 226,000 Kosovo Albanians have now crossed into Albania since the NATO offensive began. At the present rate, that will rise to more than 250,000 in the next day or so. The international relief effort now gearing up to assist Albania cannot get underway soon enough.
Clarence Mitchell in Kukës. A queue of tens of thousands of refugees stretching back into the heartland of Kosovo is reported to be still stuck at the border with Macedonia, even though NATO yesterday began erecting holding camps for up to 100,000 people. Refugees from the holding camps are being sent to other countries, including the United States. Paul Wood reports from Macedonia.
Some of the Kosovo refugees now being given a hot meal by British NATO troops at a newly built transit camp have been out in the open for almost a week in cold and filthy conditions on the Macedonian border. One woman told me that after being herded by Serb paramilitaries in a silent and terrified column of several thousand people onto the trains which left the regional capital Pristina, she didn't believe that things could possibly get worse. But she said they did, with the nightmare of being stuck with 50,000 others on the Macedonian border, without food for many days, penned in by the Macedonian riot police. The rest of her family are still there. The border is now open and people are moving off to the transit camps, but it's a slow process and international aid workers say they're still facing obstruction in moving emergency supplies up to the no man's land on the border. There are complaints too about humanitarian relief being flown into the country being held up by the Macedonian customs. Some of the Kosovo refugees will be leaving all this behind today. The first flights are expected to leave, with Britain, the United States, Germany, Turkey and Norway all pledging to take thousands of people. It's a humanitarian gesture, but also designed to combat what Western officials say is President Milosevic's strategy of fighting NATO by sending forth a stream of refugees to destabilise neighbouring countries.
Paul Wood in Macedonia. You're listening to Newsdesk in the World Service of the BBC. The two Libyans charged with carrying out the Lockerbie airliner bomb attack in 1988 have been handed over to United Nations representatives. Colonel Gaddafi agreed to surrender the alleged Libyan intelligence agents Abdul Basset Ali Mohammed al-Magrahi and al-Amin Khalifa Fahima after years of political and legal wrangling. The breakthrough came last August when Britain and the United States changed tack and agreed to a trial in a third country, though under Scottish law. Our diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason reports on the background and significance of the handover.
The Americans in particular thought it would never happen. Many were sceptical that Colonel Gaddafi would ever run the risk of the suspects possibly incriminating his own security apparatus in open court. In the end, he decided the prize of ending Libya's isolation was worth it. The handover is largely due to an initiative taken by the British Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, as African leaders began to ignore the limited UN sanctions imposed on Libya 7 years ago, principally a ban on air services. The Libyans had indicated they might accept a trial in a neutral country. Mr. Cook took up the idea at the end of 1997 and persuaded the Americans to endorse a variant, a trial in the Netherlands under Scottish law. Months of complex negotiations with the Dutch authorities followed. In August last year, Britain and the United States confirmed the change of policy, and the UN Security Council passed a resolution promising to suspend the sanctions as soon as the two suspects arrived in the Netherlands. The Libyans raised several objections. They wanted the two men, if convicted, to serve their sentences somewhere outside Scotland, where the crime was committed. That was rejected, but assurances of prison visits by UN and Libyan officials were given. Britain promised that the accused would not be interrogated by British or American intelligence. A visit to Libya last December by the UN Secretary-General Kofi Annan made some progress, but agreement was only finally reached after mediation by Saudi Arabia and South Africa and the personal intervention of President Mandela.
Our diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason. And our correspondent Andrew Castle has been watching preparations for the arrival of the two suspects in the Netherlands.
At Camp Zeist, the former airbase where the two Libyans will be held, the developments in the Middle East are being monitored carefully and preparations for their arrival have been completed. Part of an accommodation block, previously used as barracks for military personnel, has been converted into a prison, sealed off from the rest of the camp and monitored by security cameras. Barbed wire has been draped over the roof and walls of the building and metal grills conceal the windows. Everything is ready, said a British government official in the Netherlands, amid growing confidence here that the men accused of murdering 270 people in the bombing of the Pan Am flight in December 1988 will soon be in the custody of the Scottish police. The arrival in the Netherlands of two procurators fiscal, Scottish prosecutors, and the events reported in Libya have reinforced the belief that the arrival of the two suspects here is imminent. Once the Libyans arrive in the Netherlands, escorted by UN officials, they'll be handed over to the Dutch authorities, and when extradition procedures are completed, they'll be passed on to the Scottish police officers to be arrested. Only after that will they appear in private before a special court at Camp Zeist, marking the start of the formal legal process.
Andrew Castle in the Netherlands. Political leaders in Northern Ireland are to begin a week of intensive talks on Anglo-Irish proposals to break the deadlock in the peace process. All sides in the conflict were given until next Tuesday to decide on whether to accept a new plan on disarming paramilitary groups and setting up a devolved power-sharing executive in the province. The leader of the political wing of the IRA, Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, has criticised the proposals, saying focusing on disarmament would put the whole peace process in danger. The unionist leader, David Trimble, said he was optimistic that some form of disarmament would start within weeks. Reports from Russia say two policemen were shot dead and one seriously injured when their car came under fire on Sunday in the southern Republic of Dagestan. The Itar TASS news agency said the attack happened south of the capital Makhachkala. The deputy chief prosecutor in the republic was shot dead in a similar attack on Wednesday. Dagestan has been the scene of frequent violence in recent years, much of it linked to insurgency in neighbouring Chechnya. You're tuned to Newsdesk from the BBC in London. Now to recap on what's happening in Yugoslavia. For the 12th night running, NATO has carried out air raids on Yugoslavia. Local reports say various military targets were hit, including the Yugoslav Air Force headquarters. Missiles also struck Belgrade Airport. NATO says it's cutting off supplies to Yugoslav forces in Kosovo. As the United States strengthens its military presence in the region, the flow of refugees from Kosovo continues unabated. Reports say a queue many kilometres long is waiting to get into Macedonia. And still to come in the programme, reports from China, Japan, India and Pakistan, as well as the latest sports news. But first we go to Egypt, where the government has taken a first step towards removing a controversial law which exempts a rapist from punishment if he marries his victim. Rape victims sometimes agree to marry their attackers because they don't want to disgrace their families. But the custom has been strongly criticised by religious leaders and women's groups. Barbara Pletch reports from Cairo.
Egyptian ministers voted to cancel a section of a penal code that lets rapists escape punishment if they marry their victims. The change will have to be approved by Parliament to take effect, but it doesn't appear likely to meet much official resistance. Newspapers welcomed the move to abolish what some commentators called a shameful law that went against all religious values. The custom has been reinforced by strong family pressure to avoid disgrace. In many Middle Eastern countries, a woman who loses her virginity out of wedlock brings shame to her family, even if she's been raped. By marrying her attacker, the woman at least gets a certificate of marriage, although it's often followed by divorce. This practice has been strongly criticized by women's groups and increasingly by religious leaders. In January, a senior Egyptian sheikh, the Mufti of Egypt, declared that such marriages were not recognized by Islam. He said the legislation permitting them had been adopted during the colonial period for the convenience of foreigners living in Egypt. But he said the custom must now be abolished and all rapists punished. They're given jail terms and sometimes the death sentence. That's clearly the opinion in official circles as well. The justice minister quoted in local newspapers said most people felt the practice encouraged rapists and was bad for women's security.
Barbara Plett in Cairo. Reports from Algeria say 22 soldiers were killed when their patrol was ambushed by Islamic militants on Saturday night. The newspaper Al Watan says at least 12 of the militants died in the attack. The ambush took place in the Sharia Mountains near Blida, about 50 kilometers south of Algiers. The paper said several army units were rushed to the area and were besieging an unspecified number of militants. The area contains one of the strongholds of the armed Islamic group. The authorities in Cameroon say volcanic activity around Mount Cameroon could affect a wider area than originally thought. Residents of villages on the foothills have been warned that they might have to leave the area to escape lava flows, which followed an eruption last week. Now the government says there is evidence that the current disturbances extend along a geological fault, which includes Lake Nyos, where nearly 2,000 people were killed by volcanic gases in 1986. Officials have described the situation as Lake Nyos and neighbouring Lake Monoun as unstable and unpredictable. Foreign ministers of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, have opened talks in the southwestern Chinese city of Kunming, seeking ways of resolving economic difficulties, but with differences over the South China Sea still to the fore. A treaty of amity and cooperation is also reported to be under discussion. From Beijing, Duncan Hewitt reports.
Growing trade links between China and its Southeast Asian neighbours have been buffeted by the region's economic woes, and the annual meeting's agenda includes briefings by officials from China and Indonesia on how their economies are coping. Despite being a competitor in some export markets, Beijing has won praise from ASEAN members for maintaining the value of its currency, and officials from ASEAN countries are reported to have expressed backing for China's membership of the World Trade Organization on the softer terms extended to developing countries, something the US has opposed. Yet despite China's improved links with ASEAN, the sensitive subject of the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea has again been raised. The islands are claimed by China and, at least in part, by four of the ASEAN states. The Philippines has said it is seeking to persuade China to sign a code of conduct governing behavior in the region, where tension has been raised recently over what Beijing says is a fishing shelter, but Manila says is a military installation. Yet though China has said it supports joint economic exploitation of the region as a way of calming tension, it has sought in the past to deal with the issue on a bilateral basis. And a senior Chinese foreign ministry official last week rejected Philippines' proposals to take the issue to an international maritime court. And he also ruled out any notion of joint sovereignty over the region sometime in the future.
Duncan Hewitt in Beijing. Voter registration is underway in Indonesia for the general elections in June, the first since the downfall of President Suharto last year. 48 political parties have qualified to contest the 500 seats in parliament under the new rules brought in by President B.J. Habibie. Only two opposition parties were previously allowed to field candidates as alternatives to those of the ruling Golkar Party. An important survey of Japanese companies has found that confidence in the business climate has risen slightly on previous record lows. The Bank of Japan study shows that most businessmen still believe conditions are bad, but that confidence has grown a little over the past 3 months. Some analysts say that the very slight upturn indicates that the government's efforts to stimulate the economy are beginning to work, and the news helped the stock market rise. From Tokyo, Juliet Hindle reports.
Any sign of improvement is welcome in Japan, where the economy has been mired in recession since the beginning of the 1990s. Politicians have optimistically predicted that the situation will improve by the end of the year, but until now, companies have remained resolutely gloomy. The latest survey by the Bank of Japan shows that confidence may be improving very slightly. The quarterly Tankan survey measures the difference between firms saying conditions are favourable for business and those saying they are unfavourable. A negative figure means the majority of firms believe the conditions are bad. The survey released on Monday is still gloomy at minus 47, but it's a 2-point improvement on the previous 3 months. Some analysts said the upturn reflected that the government's huge stimulus measures were beginning to have an effect. But there's still a long way to go. All companies also told the survey they would be cutting spending, suggesting more job losses are ahead. Unemployment in Japan is at an all-time high, and personal bankruptcies are at record levels. The bleak outlook means consumers have stopped spending. But the stock market took the survey results as a faint glimmer of hope. The Nikkei index of leading shares rose on the news.
Juliet Hindle in Tokyo. And turning now to the financial markets, London's 100-share index is closed today, but earlier Tokyo's Nikkei index was 44 points higher at 16,334. On the currency markets, the dollar is worth 121.3 Japanese yen, the euro is at $1.07, and the pound is at $1.60.6. The United States has not yet reacted to the announcement that France is increasing its involvement in exploiting Iranian oil. Washington has urged multinational companies not to do business with Tehran because of Iran's alleged involvement in international terrorism. In spite of the request, the French Elf Aquitaine company has signed a new $300 million contract with Tehran and a Canadian oil company, Bow Valley. Under the deal, the two companies will develop and exploit the offshore Belal oil field, some 100 kilometres southwest of Lavan Island in the Gulf. Correspondents say Washington has taken no action over similar recent deals completed with Iran. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. It's now 10:21 Greenwich Mean Time. And on to sport. And Jim Courier, who guided the United States to a thrilling Davis Cup victory against Britain at the weekend, described the event as the best tennis match he's played in. And the world's top golfer, David Duval, warmed up for the Masters this week with another tournament success. The sports news from Chris Florence.
Courier's success in five sets against Greg Rusedski in Birmingham in the English Midlands completed a remarkable weekend. The British team recovered from losing both singles on the opening day to level the tie. But Courier, the former world number one, who regarded the tournament as the best in which he's been involved, eventually beat Rusedski after almost 4 hours. Despite the tension, Courier conceded that he never showed any signs of nerves.
Today I didn't. Today I was really peaceful out on the court, and I was just focusing on what I had to do, and I had my hands full with Greg. He was playing very well and playing very intelligently out there, so I was just trying to figure out a way to get breakthrough against his serve, and I finally did there at the end. It's the best standard of tennis that I've been a part of at a Davis Cup event. So far, it was very high from all players, and all the matches were very competitive.
And the United States now go on to meet Australia in the second round. In cricket, Brian Lara made it 3 centuries in 3 test matches, but his 100 on the second day of the 4th test has failed to grab control from the Australians in Antigua. West Indies will start the 3rd day at 197 for 6, still 106 behind on first innings. The American golfer David Duval can do little wrong these days. Just a week ago, he took over the world number one spot from Tiger Woods, and now, just days before the first major of the year, the Masters, he's won again. He won the Bell South Classic in Atlanta by 2 strokes. He's now won 11 of 34 tournaments in the past 18 months. In football, there are some important matches today at the foot of the English Premiership. The 4 sides struggling to avoid relegation are all playing. The bottom side, Nottingham Forest, play Liverpool, Charlton are at West Ham, Southampton go to Coventry, and Everton have home advantage against Sheffield Wednesday. And that's the sport.
With Chris Florence. Election monitors in Sri Lanka say 4 people have died in violence in the lead-up to provincial polls tomorrow. One supporter of the opposition United National Party was shot dead in the central town of Matale during the night. And on Sunday, another person was killed and 3 injured when an opposition office came under attack. The election commissioner in Sri Lanka, Dayanda Dissanayake, said security has been stepped up in an effort to control the violence. More than 30,000 police will be on duty at polling stations in the provinces, as Susanna Price reports from Colombo.
Election monitors have already recorded some 1,400 complaints of incidents ranging from murder to arson and threatening behaviour. Overnight, a labourer who supported the opposition United National Party was shot dead during a dispute in the central province. And on Sunday, a bomb attack on the UNP office in another town led to the death of the caretaker. While the leaders of all parties have called for peaceful elections, it appears their pleas have gone unheard. The incidents have led to fears of a repeat of the violence and ballot stuffing which took place on polling day in the northwestern province of Wayamba in January. On Tuesday, more than 5,000 election monitors will watch the conduct of the polls. However, the monitors are also worried about possible attacks on their own staff, which they say would cause a crisis in confidence in the democratic process. There's been little talk of any issues in the lead-up to the polls for councils, which were founded more than 10 years ago as a step towards devolution, partly to satisfy the demands of the minority Tamil community for more autonomy. Ironically, the provincial council in the mainly Tamil northeast is not functioning. The main interest in these elections is as a guide to the popularity of the various parties, which, if favourable to the ruling alliance, could lead to early general elections.
Susanna Price in Colombo. The Indian cabinet has met in emergency session to discuss a threat by a key ally in the governing coalition to withdraw parliamentary support for the government if certain demands are not met. After the meeting, the information minister told journalists that the government was not giving in to the demands, nor was it worried about its political survival. The threats and demands are being made by the colourful politician from southern India, Jayalalitha. Daniel Lack reports from Delhi on the latest crisis to plague the Indian government barely a year after it came to power.
Many in India have lost count of the number of times that the film actress turned politician Jayalalitha has taken to the national stage, threatening to withdraw parliamentary support to the governing coalition. This time she's been calling for the transfer of the defense minister and demanding a parliamentary inquiry into the sacking of the head of the Indian Navy late last year. It's quite clear that these issues are not particularly important to her, but they do provide ways of attempting to influence the government. Last week, Jayalalitha met the leader of the opposition Congress Party, Sonia Gandhi, so her threats to help topple the government are being given extra weight. So far, the cabinet is holding firm, refusing to give in to her and saying the coalition's parliamentary majority will hold no matter what she does. That's probably true, as the opposition parties would have to put together an even more unwieldy coalition were they to have a hope of governing if the current administration falls. The uncertain results of all general elections for the past 10 years in India have made coalition politics the norm, and it seems political parties are still not coping with the need for power sharing and compromise.
Daniel Lack in Delhi. Our last report in Newsdesk is from Pakistan, where the authorities have said that a new university making places available to Afghan refugees, including women, will open shortly. There are some 1.5 million Afghan refugees living in Pakistan, many of them in Peshawar. Owen Bennett-Jones reports from Islamabad on what they will be offered by the university.
Those involved in setting up the new institution say that the women going to the university in Peshawar will be taught according to strict Islamic principles. There will, for example, be two campuses, one for men and one for women. It's hoped that more than 1,000 women will attend the university. In the first instance, it will teach courses in medicine, and it then hopes to offer other subjects such as engineering, law, and literature. The Pakistani authorities say they want to help Afghan refugees get access to education, but they also say they do not want the university to become a center of political activity. The Taliban movement in Afghanistan have said in the past that they don't object to women's education, but that they're not able to open educational establishments for women until there is peace in Afghanistan. The establishment of a new Afghan university follows the closure last year of 5 universities in Peshawar, which were used by Afghan refugees. There were street protests after those closures, but the Pakistani authorities said that the 5 universities were not properly registered and didn't follow recognised curricula.
Owen Bennett-Jones. Now to our news desk, here are the main points again. In a 12th night of bombing raids on targets in Serbia and Kosovo, NATO aircraft have hit the Yugoslav Air Force headquarters and anti-aircraft command on the outskirts of Belgrade. Serbian state television is also reporting attacks on an army barracks and the training school of the Special Police Force. The authorities say NATO has bombed the city of Niš, where the Yugoslav Third Army has its headquarters, and local television has been broadcasting pictures of an inferno in the city. As the United States strengthens its military presence in the region, difficulties continue for refugees from the conflict. A queue of tens of thousands of them stretching back into the heartland of Kosovo is reported to be still stuck at the border with Macedonia. And some news just in, the United Nations Refugee Agency has now appealed to Macedonia to speed up the processing of refugees on the border. The agency, the UNHCR, said it was willing to take on the work itself. That's Newsdesk.